Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, at the core of Smarter, Faster, Better, which is the second book we're looking at today, there are eight key concepts explaining why some people and companies get so much done. It's not about doing more. I want to make that clear because I think we're all doing enough already. It's more about understanding human behavior so we can create space to enjoy more without sacrificing the things we love. And we'll hear from Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times investigative journalist Charles Duhigg around 12:30. If his name's familiar, it's because he's been on the show a couple of times with The Power of Habit, and his book's been that Power of Habit book has been on the New York Times bestseller list for over 150 weeks. And we'll be giving away three copies of Charles Duhigg's new book at the end of today's show. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome back another returning guest. Her first book, Dear Carolina, was praised as Southern fiction at its best. Now author Christy Woodson-Harvey presents a new novel about what it really means to tell the truth. Let me tell you a little bit about Christy. She's a North Carolina native. She holds a degree in journalism from the University of North Carolina and a master's in English. And she runs an interior design blog, Design Chic, and still lives in North Carolina, and she's fast built a reputation as a great Southern writer. Christy Woodson-Harvey, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that great introduction. I was a little nervous for a minute that I was going to be talking about the eight things that you need to do to be more productive, or I was like, oh no, wow.
So, and I should say, your new book is called Lies and Other Acts of Love. And I gather it's already doing very well. It's not been out very long, but it's already doing really well.
Well, it has been a wonderful few weeks. I've been traveling most of the time with my four-year-old son and my parents while my husband was home working. So we have had quite an adventure of three or four weeks, but we've had a really good time. And for me, this is just one of the best parts of the job. You know, I love getting to write the books, but I also love getting to go out and meet readers and talk about my books, and it's a dream come true. It really is.
I looked at your website and I saw your schedule for giving talks and appearances at bookstores and etc. And it runs right through 2017. You're very proactive, and this is important, though, isn't it, Christy? When you've got a book, you can't just put it out there and hope somebody's going to buy it.
Right. I mean, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think it sort of depends on who you are, maybe. And if you already have sort of a giant platform, then maybe you don't have to travel as much. But, you know, for me, this is my second novel. And when Dear Carolina came out, I was, you know, a relatively unknown quantity. And so I go out and I meet readers and I meet bookstore owners and talk to you on the radio and just have to get my name out there. But, I can't imagine ever not doing that, though, because I have so much fun. So
right. You start off in the acknowledgments in your book. You say if a first novel is a dream come true, a second novel is a dream taking hold. What does that dream look like for you?
Well, you know, I think I actually went to journalism school, and so I always knew that I would be a writer, but this was not the kind of writer that I ever thought I would be. In fact, I love the introduction for your show when you talk about ordinary people living extraordinary lives. And I think that's what really captivated me about journalism in general is that, you know, you can just, everyone has a story, and I was so fascinated by that. And so writing fiction was a little bit of a surprise for me, but it was like once I started, I knew that I had found something that I really wanted to do. And so honestly, for me, just being able to keep writing books and to keep doing what I love is kind of the dream. I mean, you know, it'd be great to have a big career and to do all those things, but, you know, to be able to keep writing books and telling stories is just really a dream for me. And so I think, you know, knowing that the second one was coming out felt like, okay, this isn't going to be just something I check off my bucket list that I've done. Like, this could actually go somewhere. So it was exciting.
Right, right. You start each chapter in your book with a piece of wisdom that's passed down. We'll get into the story in a bit, but with a piece of wisdom that's passed down, lessons learned, and one of them is do what you love and the rest will follow. But there has to be a plan behind that too, right?
Oh my gosh, yes. And you know, actually, I had this picture of successful authors as these kind of, I don't know, introverted people that sort of sat at their desks and, you know, they turned their books in and then the publishing house took over. And that is not the way that it is at all. And I have spent so much time now meeting really successful authors and watching them. And they're very type A, which I am too. So I think that's a good thing. But there's always a plan. There's always a schedule. There's usually a plan B. You know, they're usually runners. You know, like they get up in the morning at 5:30 and they run and then they write. I mean, it's very different than what I had expected, you know, when you think of like creative type people. But, you know, it is a very competitive job. It's a competitive marketplace for good reason, because there are a lot of talented people out there. And so I really think that, you know, in some ways, if you have book A and you have book B and they're both great, then a lot of times it really just comes down to who's willing to do the work. And so, yes.
That's the truth. That's the truth right there. Who's willing to do the work and do what other people, you know, can't be bothered to do. And I think that's so true in life in general. I was at an author event in Seattle on Saturday, and there were a lot of authors there. And I was quite impressed, because most of these were kind of indie or hybrid authors. You know, they work in traditional publishing and independent publishing. And I was just really looking at these women sitting, they were all women sitting, signing, autographing their books, and they'd got great crowds there. And, you know, I thought how much work had gone into all of their books lined up there. So let's talk a little about your book, Lies and Other Acts of Love. Great characterization in here. And of course, you're from the South. You live in the South. You've got this beautiful Southern accent. And one of your main characters is a grandmother, is the grandmother of Annabelle, Lynn White, alias Lovey. Yes. And I just want to read what she says and then have you just respond. She opens the book with, Lovey opens her chapter with, "My mama always told me that honesty was the most important thing in life, but I've never understood why people are so hell-bent on honesty. It's not the truth that sets you free. The truth is the thing that destroys lives, that shatters the mirror. The truth is selfish and shameful and better kept to oneself." I should have had you read that in your lovely accent. So tell us about that and what's going on in the book.
Well, I mean, of course, as it probably seems from that chapter, you know, there are some secrets in this book, and there are some mysteries for the reader to solve, and some things that have gone on in this family that aren't exactly what they seem, as I think that really there probably are in most families, where, you know, most people probably have something that other people don't know about them. And so, you know, this is one of those things that I guess is one of the big questions in life, right? I mean, is honesty the best policy? Should you always tell the truth? When your wife asks you, "Do I look fat in that dress?" What do you say?
Depends how fast you can run.
exactly. Like, I'm hungry. I need a drink. But so, you know, I think there are lots of sort of shades of gray in life. And so I really wanted to kind of explore those in this book. And, you know, I think there are people who have different levels of kind of honesty than others. But, you know, one of the things, there's obviously some things in the book that I can't talk about because they would give the book away. But I think one of the major things in this book that, you know, Lovey sort of hides, or that she sort of keeps from her family, that's one of these secrets, is she's taking care of her husband, who, you know, has always been kind of like the pillar of the family and the strong protector. And she really doesn't want her daughters to know how difficult this time is for her and how deeply she's been affected by that. You know, she sort of hides that and acts as though everything's okay to protect them. And, you know, it's not the truth, but I had to wonder, is this something that mothers do, or is this something that parents do, you know, to protect their children? And that's really what you see in this book, is things that mothers do to protect their children, mm-hmm. and whether that's right or not. And then you get to make the decision.
Yes. And I think, you know, when people read this, they'll probably reflect on their own family issues. I know there was a major secret in our family for many, 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 many years, which came as a total shock to those who didn't know about it.
Right.
And I think that's probably true in most families. I mean, it's nothing like, you know, nobody murdered anybody, nothing like that. But
right,
but
right,
something
sure.
that was very personal and, you know, didn't need to be shared, really, I guess, by the people involved.
Right.
And so Annabelle, the granddaughter, who's the other main character in this book, is the total opposite. She's brutally honest. So tell us about Annabelle a little.
Well, Annabelle, she's much younger than Lovey, obviously. She's 22. And when the book opens, she has been engaged to the guy I call the man of her mother's dreams. You know, he's like perfect on paper and he's everything that she should want, except that she doesn't, you know, and she just knows that she's not in love with him. And so she loves him, but he's not the one. How about that? And so she ends up calling off her wedding and marrying a musician that she meets at a bar 3 days later, which is where the story opens. And so Annabelle is a part of this very proper Southern family who, suffice it to say, is not thrilled with this decision that she has made to throw away, you know, this perfectly orchestrated life that she had for something that's kind of a huge question mark. And so, you know, you're really seeing Annabelle. This is really sort of Annabelle's coming of age, I think. You know, she's making a lot of her mistakes and she's making a lot of hard decisions in this book. And, you know, I think we've probably all been there, maybe hopefully not making all of the decisions that Annabelle makes, but I think that a part of growing up is, you know, kind of finding your place in the world and what you want to do and who you want to be with, if that's anyone at all. And I, you know, I really think Annabelle is doing all of those things. And she's very lucky because I think that having a grandmother that you're very close to, and I do have a grandmother that I'm very close to, but I think it's sometimes a little bit different than having also a mother that you're really close to because, you know, your grandparents have such a wealth of wisdom and knowledge and experience and have lived long enough that they realize that, you know, what seems like the end of the world maybe really isn't.
Right.
And so, you know, her relationship with her grandparents is extremely important in this book.
Right. And going back to, you know, Annabelle and some of the choices she made, it doesn't matter how many wonderful, wise people you're surrounded by, you still have to make your own mistakes to really
it's
learn.
It's part of growing up. It really is. And sometimes I'll say to my mom now, like, I can't believe you let me date that guy. Or I can't believe that you let me do such and such. And she's like, but you have to, because otherwise you don't learn. And then you keep making the same mistakes over and over again.
I remember having the same conversation with my mother, and she said it would have just pushed you guys closer together.
That's exactly. She was like, then you would have thought that you were Romeo and Juliet and you were destined for each other. And, you know, you probably would have run off with him. Whereas, you know, otherwise it just ran its course in a few months and you figured it out on your own.
Right, right. Well, we need to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about characterization because you really do develop really strong characters and a great dialogue. My guest is Christy Woodson Harvey, and her new book is called Lies and Other Acts of Love. And she's also the author of Dear Carolina, which we did a segment on a while ago. Now, how long ago was that, Christy?
Dear Carolina came out last May, and
last
I believe
May.
It was sometime last May, so about 11 months. Almost a year ago, I know, I guess. Yeah.
Good. All right, so please stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
All right, everybody in the car, let's go. What are we going to do first when we get there, Mom? Go for a hike?
Sure.
What about canoeing? Can we go canoeing, too?
I don't see why.
How long does it take to get to the forest?
It's not that far, sweetie.
Are we there yet?
Yep, we're here.
Already?
It's a short drive from your neighborhood to your naturehood. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a neighborhood park or green space near you. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the U.S. Forest Service.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Joseph J. Luciani, Ph.D., also known as Dr. Joe, delves further into his self-coaching techniques to help beat anxiety, depression, and compulsions. We'll also hear from psychotherapists Linda and Charlie Bloom, who debunk romantic myths and provide real-deal solutions in their inspiring new book, Happily Ever After and 39 Other Myths About Love. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific Time right here on Alternative Talk 1150 and catch up with podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
This is Alternative Talk 1150. Got it? Cool.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is Christy Woodson-Harvey. She's the author of Lies and Other Acts of Love. And it's an intricate look at relationships and some of the lies we share and secrets we keep. Christy, one of the things you say is that the lies that matter most are the ones we tell ourselves. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I think one of the things that this book does is, or I hope that it does, I hope that readers see is, I think it's a little bit of a comment on human nature. I think we're all pretty good, myself included, at keeping ourselves in the same patterns and doing the same things. And I think the reason that we're so good at that is because we're so good at telling ourselves that it's going to be different this time, it's going to turn out differently. Yes, maybe we're going to do the same thing over again, but it's going to be okay. And some of those things, you know, or optimism, and some of those things are just the things that we kind of have to tell ourselves to get through life. But I think it's sort of fascinating, you know, if you've ever had that friend that you're so frustrated with because she just keeps picking the wrong guy or whatever, and then finally one day you know, turn around and look in the mirror and think, oh my gosh, I am also doing something similarly horrible over and over again. And I don't know, it was just something that kind of kept coming up in my life and that I've had a lot of conversations with friends about. And but, you know, I think it takes on a lot of different forms. I mean, like in Lovey's case, you know, when she says the lies that matter most are the ones we tell ourselves, you know, really her lies to herself are kind of a self-defense mechanism, I think. And so I do think that they're important. I do think they're necessary. And I also think, you know, if we didn't tell ourselves things from time to time that maybe we're a little optimistic, we probably would never take chances or move forward because we would just be terrified all the time.
Right, right. I used to have an elderly aunt who said, there's a great deal to be said for denial sometimes,
yeah.
You know. It is a defense mechanism almost. So one of the things you said was that you wanted to juxtapose love and marriage today with how love and marriage in the 40s and 50s was, you know, between the granddaughter and the grandmother. And when you read through the manuscript, you were amazed by the parallels between the two women. Tell us about that.
Yes. And that sounds so silly because you would think that as you were writing the book, you would realize. But, you know, just little things, like when I was writing Lovey's best friend and I was writing Annabelle's best friend, they're so very similar, but the time periods are so different that at first glance, I didn't even really notice so much. You know, little things like that. But you do see Annabelle and Lovey at different, you know, they're obviously growing up in very different time periods, but you see them making or being at similar crossroads in their lives, you know, at the same time, and how they make different decisions and sort of how that ends up making their life unfold in a different way. You know, I do think, I don't know if it was the war or if it was living through the Depression or, you know, what it was, but I do think that, you know, when I look at marriages kind of in that time period, I think women viewed it in a different way maybe than they do now, which isn't a good thing or a bad thing. There are pros and cons, you know, to both. So it's not like saying, this is a good thing or a bad thing. I just think, at least in the relationships that I've seen and that I've grown up with, there's just a little bit of a different kind of feeling about marriage and what that means.
Yes, you talk about storm chasers. In fact, the first chapter, I believe, yes, the first chapter mm-hmm. is about Annabelle, and it's entitled Storm Chasers. And, yeah. you know, she's talking about her grandmother who was married to a foreign correspondent who was put over to London during the Blitz in the war. And right. That made me think of my grandmother, because you said there are people who chase into a storm, who run away from a storm. You know, they'll go down to the bunkers. Yeah. And there are yeah. people who will just stay home and tough it out and, you know, almost try and defy the storm. And it reminded me of tales of my grandmother who in the war. She would make sure that my mother was down in the bunker, safely tucked away, and then she'd rush back up, and apparently she'd pace up and down the lawn, waving her arms, you know, her fist up in the air, saying, "Come down here, you cowards! You drop bombs on us from up there. Come down here, and I'll show you a good fight." And I just thought they had this spunk about them that is exactly. just great character to build on. So that kind of leads into my next question, which is how you develop your characters, because I think you're known for your great Southern women characters. Is that an organic thing for you? I mean, how do you begin? Do you develop the character as the story develops? Do you plot out your characters, you know, strengths and weaknesses and all that good stuff before you start writing? How does it work for you?
I completely fly by the seat of my pants, to be totally honest with you. And the reason that I do that is because I actually wrote a couple of manuscripts before I wrote Dear Carolina that I never really did anything with. And I'd read a bunch of writing books about what you were supposed to do and how you were supposed to do it. And I'd made these outlines and I had done these things. But as I think I said before, I'm a little bit type A. And so if I have this detailed outline, I am going to follow that outline. And so if that character decides that they're going to be something different, or they're going to become something different, or they're going to act a different way than I originally thought they were going to, I felt so hemmed in by what I had already planned. It was like I couldn't really change it. And so now I think the fun thing is, you know, I'll get these characters and they're starting to develop in my mind, and I can kind of get a feel for their basic personalities and, you know, the tone of their voice and the things that they say. But when I start to put them on paper, it's just like getting to know a real person. You know, I feel like I really get to know them better, and I get a better feel as I go throughout the book about, you know, what would she say and how is she changing? And in this situation, you know, what is she thinking about that, you know, is making her realize something different? And I think those things are, for me, I think for some people, it's really easy to plot and outline and have a very clear vision of the story. But for me, that's really how the story unfolds. And I'm not really aware of all those little things that are going to happen until I'm kind of in it.
Which is probably why you were surprised when you went back and read the manuscript and saw the parallels between the two women.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is. Well, and this one is a little bit different because it was dual time period and it was dual perspective. And I just did like a TV interview about that, and somebody said, "I know you must have these really detailed outlines," but I really don't. And I think for me, that's how the story unfolds, you know, and how the story unfolds and what feels like the natural progression of the story. You know, I would get to a point and think, this is the time when Lovey needs to tell that story, when we need to see her, you know, in 1952 doing whatever she was doing. And that's important in the story now. And so, for some reason, I think that's just how the story tends to unfold, and it just seems to go better for me if I have less of a plan, which is so strange.
Well, I can definitely see that. I think there are times for outlining and there are times for that free flow, which is
right,
good.
Right. Maybe that's a life lesson for me, maybe.
Yeah, and another life lesson I wanted to ask you about that you share in the book. You say your most important life lesson that you've learned from your real grandmother is this too shall pass. And that's one that was always passed on to me. You know, this isn't written in concrete. This too will pass. So tell us how that's helped you through difficult times.
Well, you know, I think, especially when you're younger, I think everything feels like it is the end of the world. You know, you have a bad test or a bad day or a bad breakup or whatever it may be, and it feels like it's the end of the world. And even though, you know, I think when you're young at that particular time, you don't even believe that because you think, well, I will never love anyone like I love them, you know, when you're 14 or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, I think everything just feels so important. And I think as I've gotten older, I've really started to realize, you know, this isn't that big of a deal. And there's so many things now, like I can look back on my life and the way that things have unfolded. And I've really started to realize that every step of the way, the things that I thought were failures, or the things that I thought were setting me back somehow, were the actual things that were moving me forward. And so it's been really interesting. You know, now I think I've been able to look at life in a little bit of a different way. And I think that's what, you know, growing up just a little bit gives you that experience. But to have someone, you know, when you're growing up, to tell you that it's going to be okay and it's not as bad as it seems, you know, I think that's a really valuable lesson. Even though, as we were talking about earlier, I still think it's one of those things that in a lot of ways you have to learn on your own.
Right, right. But then, you know, once you've been through that situation, these little wisdoms stay, I think, in your head and, you know, are somewhat comforting. You say your mom, we're almost right at the end of our segment, but you say your mom probably works as hard on your books as you do. Tell us how she helps you.
Well, my mom and I do the interior design blog that you talked about earlier. We do that together, and she's just amazing. She and my dad, I mean, they, like I said, they travel with me because, you know, my husband has to work. He can't leave for 25 days at a time, and so they travel with me, and, you know, my mom does so many things for me. Like, you know, there's so many things that have to be done, like contacting a million bloggers and mailing out books. And, you know, even though I'm with Penguin and they do so much for me, there's still things that I really like to do on my own. And I have a lot of relationships that I want to keep up. And so anything that's kind of, you know, behind the scenes that she can help me with, she really does. And it's amazing because I couldn't do it without her. There's no way.
Awesome. So tell us, final question or final response, if you want, what you'd like listeners to know about lies and other acts of love, Christy.
Well, just that, you know, things aren't always what they seem, and that that life is often not black and white. And I hope that, you know, readers get to the end of the book and that it gives them something to think about, you know, whether they agree or they disagree with the way that for the things that happen in the book, you know, I hope that it makes them think about things in a different way.
Always awesome talking with you, Christy. Thanks so much for your time today. Appreciate you being with us.
Thank you, Vicki.
And you can find out more about Christy Woodson Harvey at her website, which is Christy Woodson Harvey. The book, again, is called Lies and Other Acts of Love. Please do stay with us when we come back. We have an interview with Charles Duhigg about smarter, faster, better. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
This is Martha Norwalk. every Sunday morning beginning at 9 a.m. Thanks in part to the Northwest School of Animal Massage on Vashon Island, we cover the world of animals. This week, May 8th, it's Talk With Your Animals Sunday with gifted animal communicator, medium, and Reiki master Darcy Pariso. Darcy can help you talk with and learn about your animal friends or help you connect with animals or human loved ones on the other side. Plan to give us a call on Martha Norwalk's Animal World Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Joseph J. Luciani, Ph.D., also known as Dr. Joe, delves further into his self-coaching techniques to help beat anxiety, depression, and compulsions. We'll also hear from psychotherapists Linda and Charlie Bloom, who debunk romantic myths and provide real-deal solutions in their inspiring new book, Happily Ever After and 39 Other Myths About Love. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific Time right here on Alternative Talk 1150 and catch up with podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Negativity and fear, two staples of talk radio. Well, we figured we'd try something different. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my next guest is Charles Duhigg. We actually sat down last week, I believe it was, and we recorded a segment for today's show about his new book. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Power of Habit. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list for over 150 weeks, so it's done exceptionally well. And his new book is called Smarter, Faster, Better. And it's not about, as I said at the beginning of the hour, it's not about doing more. It's about getting things done without sacrificing the things that are really important to us. And at the core of the book are eight key concepts, which he talks about during our conversation. So let me just tell you a little bit about Charles. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter for The New York Times and the author of The Power of Habit, as I said. He's a winner of the National Academies of Sciences, National Journalism, and George Polk Awards. He's a graduate of Harvard and Yale College and resides in Brooklyn. Let's bring that interview to you right now. It's about the book Smarter, Faster, Better. You're an investigative journalist with the New York Times. You have young kids. Your last book spent, or still is maybe, on the New York Times best seller list for over 150 weeks. And yet you're looking for more tips on productivity.
Well, yeah. So what happened was that the Power of Habit came out, and I was incredibly lucky in that it found an audience who seemed to appreciate it. And at the same time, I was working on this big series at the New York Times. And so professionally, things were going really well for me. But I would come home and I would talk to my wife, and I would say, you know, if this is what success feels like, sign me back up for failure. It's terrible. I'm spending, you know, every day I would get home and I would just want to have dinner with my kids and have like a glass of wine. And I would have 150 emails to deal with and all of these things that I needed to, that I didn't get a chance to do during the day that I needed to, felt like I needed to get done. And I was just thinking to myself, you know, it seems like there are people out there who have a better grasp on being in control of their lives, who seem to get as much, if not more, done than I do, oftentimes more, and sort of more kind of amazing things, and yet they still have time to play with their kids and to talk to their spouse, and they don't seem like they're running ragged all the time. And I felt like the faster and faster I was chasing things, the farther and farther I was falling behind. And so I started reaching out to researchers, and they said, you know what, you're exactly right. There are people who are more productive. There are people and companies who seem to get more done, but the reason why isn't because they're working harder or making bigger sacrifices. It's because they understand that you have to think a little bit differently in order to not be busy, but instead be productive.
And that's what this whole book is about, isn't it? It's awesome. I mean, you looked at latest findings in neuroscience, psychology, behavioral economics. You talked with all kinds of people. Tell us just a few of the people you talked with.
So I talked to the team behind Frozen, the sort of blockbuster movie, and to General Charles Krulak, who redesigned Marine Corps boot camp, to Annie Duke, who is a world famous poker champion, as well as to just sort of normal people, right? People who seem to be sort of exceptionally productive and who have figured out sort of this secret as to how to govern how their brain thinks, but also to the researchers who have spent an enormous amount of time thinking and working on this.
And the book covers, it connects 8 ideas, they're broken down into chapters. And I want to begin with motivation, if we can. I picked out a couple of chapters that I really wanted to focus on for our conversation here. And motivation is one, because let's face it, if you don't get motivated, nothing's going to get done. And you say in the book that motivation, or scientists say, it's much more complicated than self-help and leadership books would have us believe. It's not simply a static feature of our personality. It's more like a skill akin to reading or writing that can be learned and honed. So that's great news for people who lack motivation. You say also to motivate ourselves, we must feel in control. So let's talk about that a little.
Well, so you're exactly right. What we know is that motivation is kind of like a muscle. People can learn ways to strengthen their sense of self-motivation. And the way that they do that is they train themselves to look for opportunities to see choices within the chores that they have to do, to allow themselves to feel like they're in control of their own destiny and to find ways to prove to themselves that they are in control. You know, one of my favorite examples of this is there was a big study that was done of nursing home residents. And what the question that they were trying to answer was why do some people move into nursing homes and they just kind of precipitously, their health declines. They lose all motivation for exercise, for spending time with other people. And other people move into nursing homes and they thrive. They have this kind of endless well of self-determination to continue living. And what they found is the people who do well in nursing homes, they tend to have this mindset, which the researchers refer to as a subversive mindset, where they look for ways to assert control. And one of my favorite examples of this is that they were talking to this one gentleman who lived in a nursing home who told the researchers that he loved chocolate cake. And every night the cafeteria would give him a tray that had chocolate cake on it. And he would sit down at his table and he would trade his chocolate cake away for, you know, fruit or some other dessert. And the researchers asked him, why are you doing this? You love chocolate cake and yet you're giving your chocolate cake away. And he said, look, I would rather eat a meal of my own design than eat something that's forced on me. And this is actually the insight, right, which is that the people who are able to generate self-motivation are the people who look for opportunities to prove to themselves that they are in control, that you might give me something delicious, but to hell with you, I'm gonna trade it away for something else because I'm in control of what I put in my mouth. That subversive instinct, that desire to assert ourselves, that's where motivation starts. And we know this from neurological studies. And so, like, how do we apply this in our own lives? Well, think about when you're responding to emails, right? You sit down and you've got all these emails that you have to reply to. It's really hard to motivate because who wants to deal with all these emails? Well, what the most productive people do is they tend to have this trick where they open up a bunch of emails and they start typing these half sentences that are all assertions, right? Yes, I'll meet you for lunch, but I want to eat at an Indian restaurant. Yeah, okay, we can get together tomorrow to talk about that thing, but I've only got 20 minutes and we need to do it between 11 and 11:20. So they find ways to assert control that helps inspire this motivation. And then also they find ways to link that up to their most important goals and aspirations. Right, they find ways to make these activities meaningful. They go through. One researcher I was talking to was a cancer researcher, and he said whenever he sits down to grade students' papers, he goes through this mantra. He says to himself, because he hates grading students' papers, it's super boring. And he says, look, if I grade students' papers, then the university can collect tuition dollars. And the university collects tuition dollars, they can pay for my research. And if they can pay for my cancer research, then I'll save people's lives. So by grading students' papers, I'm saving someone's life. Now, that's a little bit of a stretch, right?
And right.
This guy has a PhD. He doesn't need to, like, he shouldn't have to remind himself of this. But this is kind of the point, is that in contemporary life, we get so busy that it's easy to forget why we're doing things. And sometimes motivation is simply a matter of reminding ourselves why, of sitting down and saying, why am I doing this thing? And remembering, oh yeah, the reason I'm doing it is because it actually helps me achieve a goal that's really meaningful to me. So let me go ahead and get started and get this thing done.
Right. So that is interesting that it doesn't matter how small that choice or what the choice is, it just reinforces our perception of control. And so you talk about how people can train themselves to make better decisions because, let's face it, you know, if we're in a mess, it's usually because of some of the choices we've made, the decisions we've made. How do we begin to train ourselves to make better decisions?
Well, it's interesting. So making better decisions oftentimes has to do with teaching ourselves to think about the future as multiple possibilities rather than just one binary outcome. And this is where talking to Annie Duke, the world champion of poker, was so helpful to me. Because one of the things that Annie realized is that the key to winning at poker is not to look for certainty. It's not to say to herself, I have a king and an ace, and so I'm probably going to win or I'm probably going to lose. Instead, what she does is she pushes herself to say, okay, there's five possible outcomes to this hand. And they're contradictory, but one of them is pretty likely, and one of them is somewhat likely, and one isn't very likely at all, unfortunately, because that's the one where I win no problem. And one of them is, you know, 50-50. And in poker, you can get those percentages exactly right, right? You can actually calculate with the probabilities. This is known as probabilistic thinking. In real life, it's very hard to come up with specific percentages of probabilities. But the practice, the exercise of trying to push ourselves to figure out what future is more or less likely, that oftentimes trains us to think about things that we might have overlooked otherwise, to imagine multiple opportunities and possibilities that our instinct is to sometimes ignore. Our brain loves binary choices. If given the option, our brain will always say, I'm looking at this situation as either success or failure. I married this person because they were my soulmate and they were exactly the right person for me. Or I married this person and we got divorced because they're exactly the wrong person for me. But we all know that that's not actually how life works, right? The way that life works is that you marry someone and they're great, and if you really thought about it, there might have been three other people maybe who could have been better and 12 other people who would have been a lot worse. But it's not that life is binary. It's that life occurs on a kind of a probabilistic distribution. And it's romantic to think about ourselves as being in a situation where there's one right answer and one wrong answer. And that's fine for most situations. But if you're trying to make a hard decision, if you're trying to decide whether to start a company or not, if you're trying to decide, you know, does your kid need private school even though it's really expensive? Where should I put my money if I'm going to retire in 20 years? Those are things where we owe it to ourselves not to look at the world simplistically as success or failure, but instead to say, what are all the possible outcomes that could occur? Let me try and figure out which are more or less likely. And I might get this a little bit wrong, but simply the exercise of pushing myself to go through this mental calculus, that will actually make me much, much wiser about what might end up happening and what I should take into account as I make this choice.
Right. And it's practice, practice, practice as far as decision making goes. We need to take a quick break. When I come back, I want to talk about creativity. I love this chapter on creativity. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Charles Duhigg. His new book is called Smarter, Faster, Better: The Secrets of Being Productive in Life and Business.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams. just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at pause.org or call 425-787-2500.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to, are you? Kids, work, listening to the radio. You're busy, which is great because busy people can't get prediabetes. Oh my, I read that wrong. They can. Should have worn my glasses. So visit doihaveprediabetes.org and take a short test, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Find out about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net.
Real people, real life, real radio. Really. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest is Charles Duhigg. His new book, Smarter, Faster, Better, The Secrets of Being Productive in Life and Business. And Charles, I love this chapter on innovation. And I want to look at one of the stories that you share in there. You mentioned earlier the movie Frozen. And I thought that was really interesting how when that first screening came out, everybody hated it pretty much, and they had to go back and back to the drawing board and figure out how they could make this movie work.
That's exactly right. Everyone knows Frozen as this huge blockbuster hit, but what most people don't know is that just months before it was in theaters, it was on the brink of catastrophe. And the way that they saved this movie, the way that they made it work, was by sort of reflecting on a basic insight, which is that Disney, and this is borne out by scientific studies, Disney doesn't believe that creativity is something where some people are creative artists and other people aren't, and you just need to give the artist room to create. Instead, Disney believes that creativity is a process, and that if you get the process right, anyone can be creative. And at the core of this process is asking people to draw on their own personal experiences as fodder for some type of creative breakthrough. So the way that this worked for Frozen was that when the movie wasn't working and it wasn't coming together, they called this big meeting and they brought everyone in and they said, look, stop thinking about the movie, right? Just put Frozen out of your mind. We want you to decide, what is the biggest thing that you think you could say right now? What from your own lives, what from Disney's existence could we say that's important? And the group said, well, you know, first of all, we can say something about princesses, right? Because Disney knows other companies.
Yes, they fooled a lot of us as young girls. Yes, they did.
They did. But princesses on their own, that's not enough. That's not interesting enough. So what else do we know? Well, it's interesting. The filmmakers that were working on Disney, they included a unusually large number of women. In fact, the co-director of Disney was the first female director in Disney's history.
Oh, wow.
And as they were sitting around and they were talking about this, they said, well, you know, the other thing that we know a lot about actually is sisters. Most of us in this room have a sister. And we know that what's interesting about sisters is that sisters have complicated relationships. It's not usually that there's like an evil sister and a good sister. It's that both sisters are usually kind of equally messed up and great. And you grow together and then you grow apart and come together again. And they said, what if we took this idea, our own personal experience with sisters, and what if we said we want to combine that with princess, this idea of princesses? And if we do that, then rather than having a prince save a princess, we could have two princesses save each other because they're sisters and they come together. And if we do that, then the prince can actually be the bad guy. But we don't have to reveal that to the end of the movie. And that's Frozen, right? This idea that ends up being such a blockbuster that people say is so creative and so innovative of having these two sisters save each other, and that the prince turns out to be the villain.
Right, right.
That emerged because you had filmmakers saying, I'm going to look at my own life as creative fodder, and I'm going to draw on that to figure out what I actually want to say.
Yeah. Well, interesting because, you know, you can always tell when an author has a formula going. You know, they have a few hits. I'm thinking of fiction writers. They have a few hits and then their books become formulaic. And I think you can always tell that. You say the big lesson we take away from this is that creativity can't be reduced to a formula, but creative process is different. How so?
Well, the thing about the creative process is that you need something that pushes you to actually look at your life and try and process, how do I turn my experiences into something that's a fertile grounds for creating something new, right? And with Frozen, what it was that they would have these long, extended conversations. They would force themselves to have conversations about their sisters, about their own lives, about what's really meaningful and what they want to share with the audience. For other people, like for instance for the makers of West Side Story, they wouldn't have these long conversations. Instead, what they would do is they would go and they would expose themselves to jitterbug contests and to dime store novels about gangs. And then Jerome Robbins, the choreographer, would write these incredibly long letters to his colleagues. It is so long that his colleagues wouldn't read the entire letters. In fact, they would sometimes write back and say, I only read the first 6 pages of your 30-page letter. But the reason he was writing those letters was not necessarily to educate his colleagues. They were to force him to think about what he was seeing, what he thought about it, what his experiences were like. And that's what's important, is that we recognize that the process oftentimes for creativity is about forcing ways of contemplation, of thinking into our days. And that just because things aren't working right now, just because there's tension, just because it's 2 months until the movie is supposed to be in theaters and you still haven't figured out how to make all the pieces fit together, that doesn't mean that you're going to fail. That's actually a necessary step along the process to discovery. And that the discovery oftentimes has to do with looking within and figuring out what is most emotionally authentic and true to me.
And that was Charles Duhigg, his book, Smarter, Faster, Better. And apologies if you heard my dog bark there. Normally, we do a live show right from this beautiful, beautiful state-of-the-art studio at KKNW Hubbard Radio. But sometimes when I pre-record a segment due to scheduling conflicts, I do that from my home studio. And I only just taught my dog to bark when somebody comes to the door. And so that's exactly what happened. Someone came to the door, so I couldn't be cross with him at all. All right. So real quick, you can find out more about Charles Duhigg at charlesduhigg.com. He said the big thing behind the premise of this book is that anyone can be productive. People often think that the most productive people are those who've gone to the best schools or worked for the best companies. He said, not true. The most productive people have typically gone through hardship, grown up poor, or had to prove themselves, for example, Because in hardship, you don't have the luxury of simply reacting. You have to force yourself to focus and to think about solutions. And that is the most important key to being productive, is to force ourselves to think a half inch deeper. With that said, if you have any questions on today's show, you can find me at 800-495-7617. I have 3 copies of Charles Duhigg's book to give away, Smarter, Faster, Better. If you would like a copy of his book, I will take the first, the third, and the fifth caller at 800-495-7615. 800-495-7615. Go ahead and call right now. And I think I gave the number out wrong. It's 1-800-495-7617. 495-7617. 1-800-495-7617. So go ahead and call if you would like a copy of the book, and I'll take the first, the third, and the fifth caller who leaves a message on there. And that's it for today's show. So you can reach me at info@conversationslive.net. And follow us on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair, and you'll see us on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Thanks for being with us. See you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.